My name is Rick Traer, and I'm the CEO of the Canadian Sport Tourism Alliance. And welcome to our fourth COVID-19 webinar that we're making available to the sport tourism industry on a complimentary basis. We have over 400 participants registered for today's webinar that will be moderated by Benoit Girardin, president of LBB Sport and LBB Strategies. Couple of housekeeping items before we get started. Everyone's microphone should be on mute to prevent any background noise. Please use the chat feature for any questions, and we'll do our best during the session to answer those questions, or we'll post the answers following the session on our website. A copy of the session will also be posted on our website by the end of the day tomorrow. Thanks again for participating, and now over to you, Benoit.
Thank you, Rick. Good afternoon, everyone. Very pleased to facilitate this webinar today on the impact of COVID-19 on major sporting events. I hope, first of all, you all well, and you are making your way through what we feel be a very new for us, adapting to this new reality either as a destination or as a sport organization. I'm very pleased today to have friends and Canadian sport leaders with me who have accepted to share their experience and views today. So I'm going to introduce them. First and foremost, Deborah Armstrong, who's the CEO of Skate Canada, who was my boss and I guess for 2 years as I was a general manager of the World Figure Skating Championship. And as you know, our event got canceled the day the pandemic was declared. I will remember that day for years now, forever. Thank you, Deborah, for joining us. We also have Ahmed Alawadi, who's CEO of Swimming Canada. Again, a good friend and client in sport. He saw his Paralympic and Olympic trials postponed, I should say, not canceled. I mean, we'll use postponed for now, for next year, in the context of Tokyo 2020 being pushed or rescheduled to 2021. And we also have Eugène Lapierre, vice-president of Tennis Canada, director of la Coupe Rogers, un vétéran du tennis au Canada, qui lui-même aussi également saw his event postponed, I should say, not canceled, recently, the women's edition of the Rogers Cup that were supposed to be held in August. And as far as myself, yes, I'm president of LBB Sport, LBB Strategy. I teach sport law at HSC McGill in Ottawa U. And as you know, I'm the former, yes, because our event got canceled, of the World Figure Skating Championship. Our company, we work with different organizations involved in sport, engage in sport. And over the years, we have learned a lot from experience we gained through working with major sporting events such as the World Figure Skating, most recently the FIFA World Cup bid, the Grey Cup bid, Rogers Cup and World's Gymnastic or World's Aquatics. So I hope we can share our experience today with you. This is not an easy time. We're all facing the storm and we're all in the same boat. And what I mean by that, it's not only us involved in sport or in the on the entertainment sector, but everybody is facing that situation today. And it's a very unprecedented time. It's a never before seen in history of sport. A complete shutdown of sport. I really remember that week, Deborah, I'm sure you will remember, the week of March 9 was a terrible week for the sport, for the world of sport, starting from our event, then the NBA in the evening, the Montreal Canadiens didn't play their game, they canceled a World Cup in cross-country skiing in Quebec City a couple of days after. It was a tough week for the sporting industry. But that being said, over the years, either through wars or even the Spanish flu, the sport has always resisted. You know, you can see that photo of a baseball player wearing a mask during the Spanish flu. So I think sport, the sporting industry will prevail and shall prevail. You all know that many events were canceled in Canada or postponed. And from world championships, World Cup, multi-sport games, national championship, in many sport, winter, summer sport. And of course, on the professional side as well, all the leagues got were suspended in all the sports that we know, especially in North America, but elsewhere in Europe. And it's the same around the world, where we see first the big, the mega event of the Olympic and Paralympic game that was pushed to July 2021. But the Tour de France, the Euro 2020, in my sport, Wimbledon got canceled. First time since la Deuxième Guerre Mondiale. This is big. This is very, this is quite unique. We've never seen that in our history of sport. And there are many, potentially many more to come. A couple of stats that I found very interesting in my studies or review is that from different polls and surveys, and the first two morning consultants set them all, and as you will see from those stats, it's very, very unpredictable. 48% of sport fans feel comfortable returning to sporting events live in 2020. But the next one, 72% of Americans will not return to a sporting event until there's a vaccine. And according to the Journal of Science, we may need to keep social distancing until up to 2022. And recently, the Sport Business Journal asked when the fans will feel comfortable coming back. 46% said in the spring of 2021, 51% in 2020, if restrictions are lifted. So this is interesting information, but sometimes they contradict, and I feel that it's going to change every day. It's going to change over the next few months. But I believe that the business of sport needs to restart no matter what. Maybe not in the format or in the way we're used to do business around our events, but definitely the business of sport needs to restart during the COVID time and after the COVID for sure. The impacts that we notice through our meetings with friends of sports and our either clients or friends in sport who are suffering the impacts of COVID were, I package them in four categories. Financial, obviously, people, sport, and legal. So let me go through those ones. The first one is clearly the expenses you incurred or the non-refundable deposit that you paid or lost. So that's a big hit right there. And it depends the magnitude of your event. But the big one is the loss of event net revenue or income, because from all those sources, ticketing, merchandising, concession, sponsorship, whatever they are, I hope you anticipate or you project to make some kind of a profit that will be reinvested in the sport or in the next generation of athletes. And that is a big loss. Of course, there are other, you know, financial impact as well on people who are losing their job, their livelihood. The loss of money and revenues for the suppliers, the hotels. But the big one, and I want to come back to that one, is the loss of revenues or for the financial legacy for our sport federation. And it's not like in the case of the World Figure Skating, Skate Canada. It could be the provincial federation. It could be a club who would have taken advantage of a financial legacy, and it's not happening. And sometime, depending the sport, the international federation could have a financial impact as well. And of course, let's not forget that the cities, the provinces, and Canada who are supporting our major sporting events, they lose the return on investment for the destination and the public partner and the sponsors. So we need to keep that in mind that there, a lot of people are impacted by the cancellation or the postponement of an event. On the human side, of course, the cancellation of an event is quite dramatic for the people who are involved with the event. First, the athletes. They prepare for the event. In the case of AMET, they prepare to qualify or do their best or peak at a qualification or trial event to be selected for a major game. The fans are ready to support their athletes and to see their heroes in the stadiums, and it's not happening. And the staff of the volunteers, we had for the World's Figure Skating more than 400 volunteers ready to support the crowd and the athletes during the event. And behind the suppliers, the sponsors, the media, the partners, they're people, and people who are emotionally connected with the sport. And they're usually impacted by the cancellation or the postponement. On the legal side, again, of course, you know, wearing my lawyer's hat, we've been dealing with many legal situations in the last few weeks. One of them is in fact that issue of canceling or reducing the contractual obligation due to force majeure, or what we call more in the English law or common law, the contract frustration. You mean you need to demonstrate that it was an unforeseen and irresistible situation, the COVID, and it prevented you or made impossible the possibility of hosting your event. I was reading a couple of cases when there was the Ebola tragedy or pandemic at some point. An African event tried to cancel its event, but because it was still possible, even with the Ebola, to host the event, they maintained the event and it was not canceled and not considered a force majeure. So it's a very much case-by-case analysis. But what we learn in terms of legal consideration or impact is, of course, SO, sport organization, will require or will try to include in their insurance coverage and contracts moving forward some kind of act of God or force majeure, including pandemic consideration. The question remains here, and I know, I'm sure, Deborah, you dealt with that, but which insurance program apply? I mean, is it the IF, the NSF, the actual company who hosts the event on your behalf, the suppliers, the venue? It becomes complicated when all those insurance program or contracts, come together. One big question that I learned through I did about 20 interviews over the last 2 weeks is, are governments going to require some enhanced health measures moving forward because of that situation of the pandemic? Let's say in a year and a half after we get a vaccine and we have a better level of comfort about safety going into major sporting events, are they going to request more from us, the event organizer, in terms of health precautions? And that as a condition of funding and for the facilities as well. Of course, termination of sponsorship contract and funding agreement that were partially executed is also a major legal discussion these days. I have to say that what I've been learning through my conversation with government is they're very flexible in trying to help the sports sector to mitigate risk. The host city contract or organization contract with the rights holder or the International Federation will evolve, will change. And I think at the end of the day, we all need, either as a destination or as a sport federation, we need to be able to mitigate liability exposure by renegotiating contract, transferring the risk, and of course, developing a robust risk management strategy. So what I've been hearing with the people I'm talking to or on the different working group is there's three scenarios contemplated in terms of restarting the business of event industry. Is one, nothing new for you guys. We're learning that as we go through the situation. We'll go domestic and regional first, living with the COVID, clearly. The second phase, and I don't want to put months over that. It varies from a sport to another, from a region to another, from a country to another, is hosting international events with COVID-19. We still don't have the vaccine, but travel ban are lifted and there's no quarantine for visitors coming to our country. So that's another phase that people are contemplating. And of course, the third phase is we're back to some kind of normality, which we don't know yet, But we're looking at what the science is saying is we will have to live with some new behaviors and a new norm around health precaution during a major mass gathering. Key condition to restart, I was talking to my friend Richard Lejean 2 days ago. He said, until I will feel safe going to the restaurant and be with people around me, I won't go back to a major sporting event. So the public confidence and feeling safe and accept that we have to live with the COVID-19 is something that we will need to meet, that level of confidence. Of course, mobility and travel, international travel ban will need to be lifted. Of course, we'll need to be able to travel everywhere, especially for international event. And as we discussed just before, the webinar came open, the financial viability of our event. I mean, we will in the next couple of months and maybe a year and a half, we will see our revenue reducing and we will be impacted on that front. But we might have more expenses just to implement COVID-19 measures as well. So that's something to keep in mind. The IOC and the WHO, the World Health Organization, just released a guideline. I mean, I received it this morning. It is dated April 14. And the IOC and IF worked together with the WHO to develop some guidelines on mass gathering. So number one is the decision-making factors to decide whether you should host a mass gathering or an event where a lot of people is your sport a low or high risk? Individual sport versus contact sport. So you need to analyze and assess that factor. The second one is the size of your event. Is it a small group? I mean, I was talking to the organizer of the ITU Triathlon Series that is rescheduled in the fall in Montreal, and they're looking at thinking a different format of the event and maybe not include the age group participants in their competition and just keep the elite group. So that's something you need to think about, the size of your event. Indoor versus outdoor location will be taken into consideration. What is the level of risk associated with your demographics? Are your participants at risk or do they have health condition that could put them at risk? And I don't mean by that necessarily the participant. If it would be a master's event, of course, people will be more at risk than, younger athlete. But think about your officials, your volunteers, and the people traveling because of the event. And finally, they recommend that you need to be, or will you be ready to deploy a risk communication strategy around mitigating the risk of contamination and infection due to the COVID. So that came up recently. So what we see in talking, and I saw a couple of international federation guidelines and some events that are already in the planning mode to restart their event. Of course, cleaning measures, physical distancing, adapt the actual venue and the space of the competition. The in and out rule for competitors, you come in, you play, you compete, you go out. On-site testing, new formats of competition, no fans or limited number of fans, and the crowd flow. Do we let people coming in at the same time or we give them some moments where they access the venue? No cash payment, mask available, medical team on site, and an evacuation procedure. So some sports are already in that mode, planning to host in times of COVID. A little bit of hope here and optimism, I would say, because we see some sport restarting their not necessarily their events, but their training camp. That's, alpine skiing returns to slope. And as you can see, respecting a lot of condition to maintain the health of the athletes. Tennis went on with a no spectator, no line job, no ball kids, fixed camera with no cameraman, no, and very much in a club. But that went on Tennis Channel, and it was a way to connect with the fans. But it was, of course, it was not a revenue generator at all. It was just to maintain interest for the sport. And as you all saw in the newspaper, play ball, Korean baseball is back with some artificial spectators, as you can see. And they found a new way to make the event entertaining. They had all their fans looking at a Zoom screen and cheering for their teams. And they projected this big Zoom with thousands of fans on the giant screen of the stadium while the players were playing their game. But there was nobody in the stadium. And as you see, they were wearing masks. And there was a lot of measures to protect themselves. So in my view, I have a little bit of optimism. Maybe it's my personal view of things. I believe it's going to be tough to restart the business. And realistically speaking, if we are innovative, adapt, and agile in the way we do things, we might need to rethink about our event format and model of competition. For sure, our economic model, clearly, for the next couple of months. But in my view, like I see with many sporting events around the world, it will start with the return to sport, and eventually it will come back to the return to the event, the actual competition. I was reading BC is going back pretty aggressively now in the return to life, but they said there won't be mass gathering until further notice. So it's not tomorrow we will see that. But Montreal has 5 or 6 events on the calendar in September. I don't know yet if we're going to see these events, but F1, triathlon, marathon, they're all hoping to host their event and World Cycling Tour. And I hope they will and do it in a safe and healthy environment. So that being said, anything, you have my contact information if you need to reach me at any point of time. But at this point of the meeting, I'd like to turn the question to my friend, a little bit of advertising for the next webinar of the CSTA next week. I'd like now to discuss this issue of impact of the sporting events due to the COVID with my friends who have accepted to join us today. I will start with Deborah, Ahmed, and then Eugene. And the first question I have for you, Deborah, is in a few minutes, if you could share with us your experience and about the impacts, the postponement and then the cancellation of Worlds had on your sport, and what are the key lessons learned from that experience? Deborah?
Thanks very much, Benoit. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you today. In the next few minutes, I guess I'll try to describe for you what the cancellation of our event meant to us. And I'll try to put it in the framework of what the Canadian Sport Tourism Alliance, the goals of the organization. So we ask ourselves, why did we do this event in the first place? And really, I can summarize our goals into two. We had financial goals, and we had what we call experience goals. And both of those goals relate directly to the business of the CSTA. So let's talk about those a bit. We were going to fill the Bell Centre. In fact, we did. There was at least one of the four nights that were completely sold out. We sold millions of dollars of tickets to fans from across the world. So, you know, Canadian and Americans were the majority, but significant component of our ticket sales went to the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Koreans. So I've just said the three countries that were probably the hottest spots in the world as it relates to COVID-19 coming into March. So we did it for sure to make money, and I'm going to talk about the impacts of that in a minute. But the other reason we did it, which is critical and should not be lost in the discussion, is for what we called experience. We wanted to give our fans, the athletes, the coaches, everyone participating in our event, a world-class experience. We wanted to show them what Canada could do, how we host events. We wanted to showcase the city of Montreal in the biggest way that we could. In addition to the actual sporting competition, we had organized 19 ancillary events. That meant 19 nights out in bars, in restaurants, celebrating various aspects of what we're doing, We had a very large fan festival external to the Bell Center that had been planned. We had numerous in-venue activations planned. We wanted the people at this event to go away saying, wow. What does that do for us? A number of things. Obviously, we hope that it not only entrenches the fans we have, but we hope it brings new fans to our sport so that we can continue to grow and continue to be popular out there in the world. What does it do for the city of Montreal? I mean, a lot. We were bringing in millions. We all have to run our reports. Millions of dollars to the local economy in the form of hotel nights, in the form of restaurants, in the form of ancillary shopping, et cetera, et cetera. So those were our two goals, and we didn't have an opportunity to do either. And let me talk you through that. So obviously, financially, I will say, I mean, the numbers are not all in, and we obviously have financial year end to go through, but we will suffer a financial loss on the event. We're lucky. In many of our major contracts, we did have force majeure clauses, or quite frankly, we were able to rely on laws relating to frustration of contract, as Benoit pointed out to you. So we were able to recover in some cases, but there is a large dollar value of expenses that were sunk. They'd been sunk over the 3 years in which we planned the event. You know, we asked people to provide for us, as an example, carpets for use in the Bell Center. Well, they did provide those carpets. We need to pay for those carpets. We have carpets now. I don't know what we'll ever do with them again, but in fairness, we needed to pay those providers for the work that we requested that was fully performed for us. So we didn't have the revenue. We did get the expense, but I will also say, and I want to put a plug in here for the public funders. So Skate Canada's event is different than I think what Eugene will talk about in a few minutes. Our event was not just reliant. It wasn't a wholly commercial event. It was also supported by public funding. So, you know, we have been somewhat fortunate that the public funders, both in Quebec and through the Government of Canada, have not required us to return the entire amount of the funding. There are rules and regulations around that funding, and we are sticking with that. But so we were somewhat sheltered by the fact that some of our revenue was not entirely commercially based. We will suffer financial loss. More importantly, it was the legacy we were going to build. So we knew coming out of the event that if it was going the way that we knew it was on Wednesday, March 11th, when the event was canceled, we would actually create a financial legacy, which in accordance with our public funding agreements, we would have had an opportunity to use into the future, both in Canada and in Quebec. So it did benefit not only Canada, but Quebec in particular from a sport perspective. We've lost that opportunity. And unfortunately, the ISU has already awarded the World Championships in 2021 and 2022. So they've effectively told us, we feel badly, but you have to get back in the queue. And quite frankly, an event comes to North America once every 5 to 7 or 8 years. And next up would be the United States. So we do not know when we will have an opportunity to create that legacy again. The second thing I want to mention is, of course, the experience. We didn't have the experience to show the world what we could do. We didn't have the experience to highlight Montreal. We didn't have the experience to show, and to the benefit of all who are going to run events, that you can come to Canada and have a great time and see a great sporting event, which is really what the Canadian Sport Tourism Alliance is all about. So we lost the opportunity to provide that experience. You know, as I wrap up my comments, I want to address two points that have come up, and, you know, we could talk about this for a very, very long time, but Benoit showed us a survey that suggested for 2020, 50% of people would consider returning to an event. Skate Canada has 3 international events between now and the end of October. So even if everything clears up between now and the end of October, we're looking at 50% of people who might be prepared to buy a ticket, might. So what does that mean for the events that we have planned into this fiscal year? You showed us another stat, Benoit, that people said they wouldn't return to a sporting event until a vaccine was available. Well, quite frankly, I don't know of any country in the world that can mandate its citizens to take a vaccine. So even if a vaccine is available, it does not mean everyone is going to get it. And it certainly doesn't mean that you're required to show your vaccine card as you walk into a public stadium. So I don't think the vaccine... It may reduce fear. It's not going to resolve fear because you can't force that to happen. So I would leave you with this. We, you know, I will say this. In the scheme of things, it's no big deal that the World Figure Skating Championships were canceled. Lives have been lost. People are very ill. The economy has been devastated by this crisis. So when you put it in context, Skate Canada had a bit of a bad year. We will recover from that very differently because we do rely on our events to generate as a source of our diversified revenue streams. So there's an impact today into the future. We're very concerned about membership-based programming because COVID-19 not only impacts large events, it also impacts grassroots programming. You know, am I going to bring my kid back to the, you know, rink and have them skate beside somebody else who may or may not have an infectious disease? So we will see. But we've learned a lot. So I say what we learned, and this is the lesson I'll leave you with, is that we weren't ready enough. We really thought we had it nailed. We had everything considered. We had contingency plans in place, but we didn't consider an event cancellation, really, when we were 5 days out. And we didn't consider a scenario where there would be no ice in Canada. Who could imagine there is no ice in Canada? Because right now, it's starting to lift. For a period of 8 weeks, every facility that has ice in this country was closed. So it's been an experience, Benoit. We will continue to learn and grow from it. I'm a little less optimistic than you about what the short-term future of sporting events looks like, unless and until we get really good clarity from our provincial governments as to what is going to be allowed to happen from a mass gathering perspective. I think we have to be cautious. And in the case of an organization like ours, we are asking ourselves, at what point does not being able to sell tickets to a maximum audience make our event just, quite frankly, you know, really not an acceptable event to run? So I'll leave you all with that. Thank you for your time. And I do hope to see you at a figure skating event soon.
Thank you, Deborah. I like the point about that. You know, we have to put our situation in context here. You know, people are dying out there, and it is a drama for our people, for our society and economy. And I like the fact that, yes, we lost, we incurred loss, but we have to put that into context. Thank you so much. Ahmed, on your end, I know you had in April the Olympic and Paralympic trials scheduled in Toronto. And, you know, as an important step for athletes to qualify for Tokyo 2020, now 2021. So can you share your experience with that and how COVID-19 impacted your sport? Ahmed, you're on mute, I think.
My apologies. First of all, thank you, Rick and Benoit, and my counterparts here, and everyone on the line for tuning in. Merci beaucoup à tout le monde pour d'être ici. I think so certainly the impact is that we realized we don't know what we don't know. So we had contingency plans for disasters. We had contingency plans for financial issues, for human issues. But this thing was far greater than anything that we could have planned or imagined before. It didn't just affect our Olympic and Paralympic event, but I will speak to that. It affected every other Swimming Canada event, our Masters Nationals, our Summer Nationals, our selection events for karting for this upcoming karting cycle. Every one of our PSO events have been canceled. So it's had a profound impact, but I'll go back to the Olympic and Paralympic event. So we too are fortunate that our government agencies, both in Ontario and Canada, have stepped up provide some flexibility, for lack of a better term, with the funding that they've provided. Swimming Canada does have a diversified revenue stream. All that being said, we are going to feel an impact. And without the risk of repeating too much of what Deborah said, The sunk costs are the sunk costs. Those things that have already been delivered, they're paid for. The HR that has already worked on it was invested. And so that is going to be a loss for us. Things that we are going to have to look at seriously is revisiting our legal contracts. That being said, on the most part, there many of the organizations that we sign legal contracts with or without force majeure, we were able to renegotiate some kind of amicable deal, but not in every case. So we will take a hit, and it will not be at the size of Skate Canada or tennis. But if we count all our events together, it will be significant. We need to revisit our business continuity plan. So the one that we had in place needs to be revisited. Our three priorities in any business continuity disaster are cash flow, budget, and HR, in that order. So for us to ensure that we're sustainable moving forward as an organization and as a sport, those are the three key areas, and they are being analyzed daily. And so the trials has had a very significant impact from that standpoint there. And we've had to make immediate adjustments, cuts across the board, adjustments in HR, adjustments with our sponsors, not only sponsors for that event, but our multi-year sponsors who are likely taking worse of an impact than we are at the moment. So if you're dealing with a retailer right now that's a brick and mortar retailer or a gas company, they are in a very difficult position right now. So the impact from here is gonna last for years. But I know a second question is coming, and so I do want to talk about some positive stuff in the second question. We've also learned that the impact to mental health, to our athletes, coaches, officials, and our fans has been far more significant than we would have ever planned that something like this could be. Sometimes you plan for a storm. This was an all-out earthquake, tornado, you name it, hit all at the same time. And being so close to qualifying and living out your dream and training for 20 years, whether you were the official training for 20 years to get there or the athlete or the coach, it was almost like a death in the family, for lack of a better term, the way the people felt it. And so are in the process of addressing that as well. And I'll talk about that in the second half of your question later on. To be honest, I think we underestimated what was actually possible in terms of impacts to our sport. We thought a facility could be affected or a region could be affected, but not a global pandemic. And so, and likely the risks of that, of seeing that, even with SARS and H1N1, didn't hit to this level. And so the impacts right now, we're reeling from them. But when I get to the next question, I'm going to talk about how we're coming out of it. And so these lessons that are learned, we've taken those lessons. We've learned them. We've suffered the injuries, both mentally and physically. But there's a plan to get out. And we have to think out of the box. We have to revisit our business models. We have to do things we've never done before, try things we've never tried before. The damage is done. If the house is burned down, you can't just stare at it and it's going to build itself again. So we're going to have to move forward and do things that we've never done before. But the impact, dramatic. So future registration, Absolutely. But one thing that hasn't changed, and I'm certain it hasn't changed at tennis, skate, or any of the other 60 to 70 sports, is those that love that sport still love it and want to get back in and are looking for a way to do that. And they're looking to us for that. And so there are external factors and there are internal factors. And I think the love of tennis, the love of skate, the love of swimming is there, and the love of all those other sports is still there, and people want to get back. And so we have to absorb, accept, and then move on from this. And we've absorbed and accepted, and now we're moving forward. It may not be perfect, but we're moving forward, and we'll get to that in the second half.
You already gave us a little bit of a teaser here about what you will say in a few minutes. So
yes,
I appreciate the fact that not only you suffered the financial impact, but also the impact on people. And I think it's central here. Thank you, Amin. Eugène, your event got canceled recently. Postponed. You'll explain that in a minute. And we don't know yet about the men's in Toronto. But for sure, the women's tour, the WTA, has been canceled for Montreal due to the fact that the provincial government imposed a ban of major events until August 31st. So what can you share with us at this point of time about the impacts of the postponement of the Rogers Cup?
Yes, thank you, Benoit. Thank you for the invite. Really appreciate and sharing all these questions with the Deborah and Ahmed and all the others there. And I'd like to stress, yes, the importance of what Deborah said about putting things in perspective. I think it's very important. My team, people working with me, they'll tell you, I have one saying that I've been repeating every year. When things get hot, when people panic around the event because there's a banner that is wrong with a sponsor, because it's raining, because this and that, I'm telling people, hey guys, remember, this is just tennis. We're not saving lives out there. So, well, for once, this applies very well to this situation. This is sport. We're having fun. It's very important for life, for society, having sport around, and we see it because we're missing it now, and everybody's like tired of watching reruns and stuff. But in the end, we will be part of the recovery of this society when we all come back together, and be able to present the sport. But for the time being, there's more important things, and we see that every day in the news and everything. So yes, it's been a big hit. The fact that we've been postponing Coupe Rogers in Montreal until next year, we don't know yet, as you mentioned, what it's going to have or what's going to happen with Toronto. But listen, we just know it's a question of time. The tour, the ATP tour, has told us that they would make a final decision on June 1st at the latest. So we have a few more days, weeks to wait, and we don't see any sort of chance that it can be held. So if both events are postponed, and for yes, you're right that we've stressed on the fact that we want to postpone, because it's going to be the exact same show next year. So it's like when Justin Bieber says, "Oh, I'm sick, and I can't sing tonight," and the show is postponed 9 months later. Everybody keep their tickets and go see Justin Bieber again. So that's what's going to happen with tennis. We're going to show the women in Montreal next year and the men in Toronto next year. So we'll encroach to that alternation between both cities that we've had for 40 years for the first time, though. So we'll keep the ladies. So we tell the people have their tickets. Hold on to your tickets. It's the same program, same players, same seats. Everything. So it's just keep it, and hopefully they will keep it, and they do up to now. It's a pretty good response from our fans, and they just want to wait until next year and come. So that's why we use the word postpone. But But our model is simple, not unlike other NSOs. And we've been very fortunate over the last many years to be able to count on an event like this. We have one of the major events on the Women Tour, the WTA Tour, and one of the major events on the ATP Tour that we alternate between Toronto and Montreal. And yes, we do this to promote the game, and it's the best window for tennis that you can imagine in Canada. But it's also to make money. I mean, it's the means with which we develop the game. So, and people don't always see that. We're in the sports business, and most, I suppose most people attending this webinar know what it is, but the people out there, that they don't know. And we have to say that all the time. Listen, the Coupe Rogers, yes, it's a pro event. Yes, it's a major event, but we do this to develop the game. I tell people, my job starts on the Monday after the tournament. That's when we start developing the game and using those dollars to get kids playing tennis, to get people on the courts, and that's what we do. So losing both events, we've lost 90% of our revenues. Those two events make for 90% of all the dollars we spend into the game. So, as you mentioned earlier in your intro, we lost, of course, all the 2020 revenues, incurred costs that we had organizing those events, and we also factored in probably a less profitable event in 2021. We don't know what's going to happen. We may talk about that in a few minutes with the next topic, and. But we factored that in, and for us, so we evaluated a net loss of near $25 million. So what we did short term now is trying to mitigate by cutting programs big time, development programs, and cutting, unfortunately, jobs. So we've got about 40% of our employees we had to let go. Another 30% we will let go temporarily with the hope to bringing them back as soon as possible, hopefully in the fall or maybe sometime in the new year. And we've kept a core group of 30% of the staff to keep running the business until then. So this is a major cut. So we were able to lower that downfall by at 17 million at this point. So still, it is still a huge amount. So we believe that it'll take at least 3 years to come back to put us back afloat. So the next 3 years to try to recuperate of this major blow at this time. Yeah, so that's what it is. That's what we're looking at. So you asking what sort of lesson would be learned of that. First lesson, never have a pandemic anymore. That's the number one thing. We'll try that very hard. But it's tough because, and we'll see how we can change the business. I think we'll talk about that in a little bit. But when we look at it, and the only tournament in the world that was covered, when we talk about insurance, and I think it's the only event, even in the culture, I didn't hear La Scala de Milan or anybody else being insured for business stopping suddenly like this. So it's a Wimbledon event that got an insurance about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, when the SRAS pandemic hit. So they thought it would be better to insure themselves against something like that. And they did, and it worked. It's fantastic, but it's out of the question that any of our tournaments, regular tournaments, could buy an insurance like that. I know the US Open doesn't have one. I know Roland Garros doesn't have one. That's why they stepped over everybody and declared one-sided that they would they would just postpone their tournament to the fall over anything else that was programmed at that time. It pissed off everybody. It pissed off the WTA, the ATP. But Roland Garros said, well, no, I'm sorry, but if we're going to be losing 120 million euros, we better like just try to save it and put it at the fall, which they did. We don't know. Cross fingers. Maybe they don't. Maybe they play it. Maybe they don't. U.S. Open. I'm having meetings with the WTA and the ATP every week. They still don't know what's going to happen. They're looking at holding it without people, without fans. Not holding. They're in for humongous number of dollars that they would lose if they don't hold that event. So insurance, I don't know. I think the lesson that we will learn as Tennis Canada and our board of directors will certainly discuss this in the months to come, years to come. But I think we need to build a reserve, which we did not do. We put all our dollars. We keep a little bit of a reserve for tough days, but not that amount. Not that amount. We put everything back into the game. We put all the dollars we do back to get the kids playing the game and everything. So maybe we'll say, okay, we need to keep a few marbles aside in case and at least get a year behind our back and try to see it coming when something that hard would hit in the future. So that's really what I would say at this time, because other means of solution that may be around the corner for the future, we'll discuss maybe in a few minutes.
Indeed, Eugene, I mean, in your case, in the case of tennis, and maybe it's different than the other sports, it had a huge impact on the economic model of the federation. You know, I think I read 90% of your federation's revenue were coming from the Rogers Cup, and you just said you reinvest all that money in the next gen and the game and of course
yes, you know, that's one point that I think Ahmed or maybe Deborah, you talked about that. Unlike some other organization, at least for Coupe Rogers and Rogers Cup, we have zero funding from government, and we don't ask for funding. We know we're profitable and it's good, but we have none from the feds, none from the provincial or the city. So we're kind of proud of that. maybe we'll go to them for a bit of help for the next couple of years.
Thank you Eugene on that one. Thank you for all of you. That was very, very entertaining. I'd like to talk to my boss, Rick Traer, for a second here. Rick, can you come online, please? Just want to make sure that if we go a little bit beyond the 2 o'clock, we're good or not. So, Rick, can you please come back to the call?
Oh, we are at 2.
We're good, Benoit.
We're good? Okay. So we'll spend another 10 minutes together, guys. And this time we'll try to, as we say, get to the point about how do you see the future, short-term, medium-term, or long-term, in your sporting events. And that's the focus of today's conversation, is how do you see next? How do you see your sporting events, restarting in the next couple of weeks or months? What are your views on that? So Deborah, maybe you want to go?
I'll go quickly. So we are holding out hope, despite the fact that I'm not maybe as optimistic as you, Benoit. I am hopeful. So I mentioned we have 3 international events scheduled between August and the end of October, and we have not taken any of them off the docket. The problem with international events, as you pointed out in one of your earlier slides, is they're reliant on international travel. And, you know, it's one thing to be okay in the country. It's another thing to bring people into the country. And right now in Canada, if you travel from any foreign jurisdiction, you have to self-quarantine for 14 days. So it's impossible to come to any sporting competition, but most certainly a figure skating competition, and put yourself in a hotel room for 2 weeks where you're not doing any training in advance of the event and expect that you can perform at the same level. So we are hopeful but nervous. And what I mean by nervous is we don't actually believe it. We think the COVID restrictions might be lifted enough that we could actually stage the event. We're just not sure we're going to have the participants or the athletes have the opportunity to come into the country and compete in the event. So I would say I have no crystal ball, because if I did, it was a very bad crystal ball. It did not work well at all. But I think we think that the international competition season in figure skating until the new year is going to be light. I think I'll say that.
You're right, because you have a tour of a few events, SCI being one, and there are
the Grand Prix series.
Grand Prix series, and you know, it's going to be very, very interesting to see and how the travel ban will be lifted and allowing not only athletes to travel, but also countries to accept visitors.
And the other comment I would like to make, yes, you're right. And the other comment is, of course, you have to have safe return to training, right? So our IST specialists are telling us that it takes between 10 and 12 weeks for an elite athlete, a figure skating athlete, to mm-hmm. safely return to a certain level of competition. So the last thing we want is our athletes to rush back onto the ice and hurt themselves and then have significant issues, not only for this season and for others. So, you know, unfortunately, we're at the mercy of time. You know, I just heard Eugene say they on June 1 is literally days away. So, you know, when we get to 8 to 12 weeks before an event, it's almost too late to have safe training for competitors. So it's complicated.
Indeed, it is complicated. It's very, very complicated. And Hamed, what are your thoughts about the future in the next couple of months? Hamed, you're on mute.
Just didn't want you to pick up the background here. We've taken a bit of an optimistic view. And so we've published our calendar for the next 12 months, subject to change. So we've made the decision that once we've gone through this shock, we're either going to give up and hold back or we're going to fight. And so, but at the same time, we're not going to risk lives. So we've from the high performance program down all the way to our grassroots, the return to swimming, which will be published in a couple of weeks, and some of the protocols, and we've partnered with some of our brothers and sister sports or organizations like Life Saving or Red Cross. We're working together to publish something in the next couple of weeks that will, at the end of the day, have to be modified at the jurisdictional level, at the facility level, at depending on whatever the rule is in that province, that municipality, or that particular building. We know also that there's an economic impact to our membership. And so in publishing our schedule for next year, we've taken that into account and reduced the amount of events by combining them to reduce the cost. Our Olympic and Paralympic trials went from 7 days to 5. And so we've taken those measures already in advance. Now, one would say you're being too optimistic by publishing. Well, it's a plan. And if we need to change the plan, we will change it. We also have taken the approach that we are super thankful to the Government of Canada, super thankful to the provinces that have helped financially. But we also need to look in the mirror and make those adjustments to be able to become more diversified and more sustainable. And finally, never underestimate for us, and we know this from the people who love swimming or who love sport, never underestimate who's willing to do what to help, whether they're paid or not paid. And I'm going to call out Deborah right now, because last week I called her for advice. So never underestimate who's willing to help you. And so there are, from our standpoint, and Eugene touched on it, this is the first time in our lifetime that we're asking, we're actually risking lives in sport. And so we have to take that into account. And so when some big decisions have to be made, we cannot be shy for me to pick up the phone and call Deborah and ask her opinion or call someone else. And so we need to work together. And then finally, I'm going to close off on sport is one of three key areas that need to be restarted. And we will take a phased approach. You'll see our plan. But the arts and the social activities, the festivals, the jazz festivals, the food festivals, all three are linked together in terms of healing our communities and moving forward. And whatever that new forward is, after every world war, society was never the same after. And it grew into something new. This is a very similar atmosphere that when we evolve from this a year, 2, 3 years, we will have some type of new future. It doesn't have to be negative. It could be positive. And we are being challenged right now to think out of the box. We are being forced to do that. So we should take that opportunity to do that. And I don't want to go into too many details because I'm going to let my staff announce all the changes that we're going to make, but many will be different and many will be improvements on things that we've done historically that maybe we should have changed. So with all the negativity around this, there are some positives that we can do. So moving forward, we're looking forward. We will make changes as we need to. We will adjust as we need to. We will let the community heal as we need to. And but I think we will come out of this and all of us will come out of this. But it's going to take some time and there may be some pain. We might trip and fall here and there, but you know, people who are in sports trip and fall all the time. You have to get up and keep going.
And doing that together and not hesitate to reach out to our friends in sport is very central to pass through that that bad moment, put it that way.
Absolutely.
Eugene, I know you already, well, you made the decision to, you know, to reschedule, I mean, to postpone the Rogers Cup for next year. Same thing, same day, same format, same seat, same players. But on the other hand, you have other events. You have, are you taking to change the way you're going to do or run your events moving forward?
Well, if you're talking about pro events, I think that pro sport will come back. And entertainment sport will come back. We just don't know when. And hopefully also when there's a vaccine, and yes, okay, that's good. According to Trump, it'll be like in a couple of weeks. So let's see, but maybe it takes more time than that. And you have different views on that. So, but I think it's gonna come back. And you quoted my friend, Richard Legendre, saying that when he feels safe going to have a meal in a restaurant, then he'll feel safe going to a mass gathering like sports. And maybe that's exactly what it is, when people's confidence come back. Until then, what do we do? And that's the question, really. When we think short term, mid term, in our case, it's going to be next year for Coupe Rogers and Rogers Cup in Toronto. And I know that people have been looking at ideas about with less people, with keeping the distanciation, the distancing from people. But to tell you frankly, I don't believe in that. First of all, very simply, already for next year, we had sold close to 70% of our tickets. We had a number of sessions almost sold out at this point already in early March before we start. So what do we tell? Are we going to pick and choose who can come and cannot come? Do we skip a row? Do we skip three seats to keep the 2 meters away and everything? What do you do on the grounds then? How do you space the people? Do you give a mask to everybody just to make sure? Do you test them at the entrance and everything? I don't see that. I don't think having just a fraction of the people in the stands will make it work. Second, third, fourth of all, because a pro event is a show. It has to have hype, and the hype comes from the people around the court. And even when you watch on television, you want to see those people clapping and yelling and everything. That makes the show actually. And unfortunately, we're going to lose that until people feel safe to come back in a mass gathering environment like we have on the screen here. And so, what we do until then, the only solution, because people will want to see sport. They will want to see the top athlete in action. It's going to be through television and all the visual platforms that exist. We don't have a choice, but people will demand that. They want to see live action. So how do we set that up so that it's as financially viable as possible? Because there's only three, in our case, I suppose, we have three sources of revenue. The gate, ticket sales, that's going to disappear. Second is commercial, the sponsorship, our partners. Are they going to want to sponsor at the same level? Probably not. But how can we manage? How can we work the deals to be different? How can we give more visibility in different shape or form and everything? That will be something that we will need to study with our partners and within a new model that can be out there. And the third level, the third source for us is TV rights. TV rights were on the rise, really, on the men's side, on the women's side, the same. And it's not going to go down. That one is not going to go down, especially if you cannot attend the event on site. So that one will need to be tapped very good. So those are the three levels, the sources. But it's not at short term, it's not as profitable. So we have to rearrange limit our expectation a little bit next year. I don't know what's going to happen. If we run the event without the spectators, we know we're not going to make far from as much money as we would have made with the spectators. And so that's what we will be looking at. I know the tours and us, of course, everybody, we speak together and we're looking at things, different things to, and if we have to, even if we have to hold the event with no spectators, there's a lot of hurdles. We've talked about them, travel, opening the frontiers have to reopen and everything, borders. And of course, but even then, if all of this is good and you have all those players on site, those athletes, their entourage, the officials, the transport, the people, and you're still going to have a couple hundred people, several hundreds of people on site. So you have to be very, very careful with everything. So we already, and you talked about the try that they did in Germany with nobody around. So that means maybe, yeah, the system exists already for calling all the balls in tennis without officials. Maybe we ask the players to run their own balls and things like that. So you can cut the number of people that you would need normally in a tennis match. And we've discussed also, okay, let's keep activities on site to a minimum. You don't even need a locker room because you get into the shuttle back to the hotel and take a shower over there. That's
in and out,
and that's it. So you need very little food or anything on site. So just have the place to show. And even then, when you look, you think about it, you say, well, if it's only on television, it could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be in a stadium if you don't use the seats. It could be on the top of Montreal. It could be like on the side of a lake or anywhere. It could be in a different country. We could hold Coupe Rogers or Rogers Cup at in Florida, USTA has in Orlando has a site with 100 courts. They could probably hold 3-4 tournaments at that same time. Okay, you play Canada, then you change the banners and you play Cincinnati. Well, that's not fun. I mean, that's not fun, but that's something that could take place if you're looking at the feasibility of things, saving costs, getting the players into action, getting all the players at the same site for a long period of time is probably what's the best, something that would be feasible. But when you take all the travel in consideration, the quarantine from going one place to another and everything, so they could play a part of the season at the same location would be
a little bit.
We're looking at these ideas, but I don't know which one will come out. But that's the type of thing we have to be think out of the box a little bit.
And you know that the NBA and the MLB are looking at bringing a couple of teams in the same city and play a few games, reduce the number of travels and transportation. So very, very, very interesting from all of you guys. And, you know, I'm very impressed. I still look at the number of participants. We're still at 240 here. And I think, Rick, I'd like to I had about the 15 minutes wrap up, but I won't go there. I just want to tell you guys on my personal behalf, thank you so much. You've been very generous in sharing your experience, your thoughts, and your vision about how we're going to relaunch this industry, which won't be easy, but we're going to get there at some point. So, Rick, I'd like to go back to you. I don't know if you want to, and Ahmed, Deborah, and Eugene, if you guys are too tight, please, you can leave by no means. But, Rick, do you want to put one or two questions from the participants, or I'd like to turn that to you, please.
Sure. There was one question. There were number of questions, but I think most of them were covered, Benoit. But here's one perhaps that panelists could weigh in on. The Miami Dolphins are planning for a maximum of 20-25% of their stadium being filled for their upcoming games, and that's fine for those leagues or franchises that have significant television revenue to kind of create that buffer. But what about the most of the other events that do not have a significant television revenue stream, and what about any thoughts about the sustainability of those events, or what adjustments might need to occur to ensure their sustainability into the future?
Yes, well, that's one thing that we looked at and when we studied the fact of playing the event without spectators or with a very limited number of spectators. We don't see it financially at this time, and because the rights, as the person was referring to, they're far from being comparable to the NFL or NBA or baseball, or so it's not profitable at this time. So if we're even starting to see the negotiation with the athletes themselves, that if you want to see that happen, if you want to play in front of an empty stadium, we may have to renegotiate the prize money, because it needs to work. It needs to work on both sides.
I will say, for the nature of our events, which is nowhere near the commercial undertaking that, you know, Eugene is talking about, Coop Rogers, etc., Rogers Cup, it's probably economically not viable to run the kinds of events we run without a gate, or with a gate that is reduced to the point that we can't even come close to covering the expenses associated with the event. So that will be a deep breath for us, because that's going to have to cause us to reconsider how do we do it. And I'll be honest, that's another one of those business continuity plans that we have to do more thinking about. We just don't have the benefit of the crowd. We have a very distinct demographic who follows figure skating. We love them and we appreciate them greatly. But they are who they are, and they're prepared to do what they're prepared to do. And so we do rely on our ability to sell tickets for two reasons. A, for those that actually are financially successful, because it also covers those that aren't, because we need them all. So very tough for an organization like ours with the kind of events we run if we have reduced ticket capacity to 25%. Mm-hmm.
I would say from I think swimming's maybe the most fortunate out of the three of us up here. We run around 6 to 7 national events a year, but we sanction over 600 events a year. And so we're less dependent on the gate revenues because the revenues for us come in other areas. Don't get me wrong, the gate revenues for our mega events are important, but I think we could have the most flexibility to adjust our business model in a shorter period of time. There'll be some pain, there's no doubt, but I think if I was to compare swimming to tennis or to skate, our ability to do that, we're just fortunate that we can adjust it easier. Would I love to have $24 million and $50 million gate revenues like tennis? Absolutely. But at the same time, that's not our business model. And so our business model is different.
But you have a couple of...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Bimal. Can I just pick up on something that I think all of you are seeing here, which is something that has become much and much more pronounced in light of this crisis, because we've had to face it. You're looking at three, what I would say, highly successful sports in this country. You're looking at three completely different business models. So how we are all impacted by these things is very different. And our ability to react to them is very different. And one thing I think we've found in our dialogue since, because we've talked a lot as sport leaders since the COVID pandemic. I mean, we talked before, but we've talked a lot more now, is there isn't a model that is consistent. And we have to be mindful of that, because I do think there was a time in sport in Canada when it was more the same, but that isn't what we're experiencing today. So it's been an interesting lesson for us.
Okay, thanks very much. Benoit, you got 30 seconds for wrap up.
Well, and I will take 10. Guys, thank you so much. That was great. I mean, you provided so much good insight, and you were, again, as I said, very generous. Am I still optimistic? I guess I am optimistic, realistic now, and hopeful. I like that, Deborah. I mean, hopeful is the key one. I think through innovation, agility, and rethinking about how we do things, I mean, there's no doubt that we will come back to what we did before, what we do. I mean, I don't see the Rogers Cup being completely virtual. I mean, otherwise we'll have to do something else. So in my view, I'm hopeful that, you know, I don't know how many months we will be back to normal business. So thank you again for your time. And and thank you for the participant. We still have 200 people on the call, so that's great, on the webinar. Yeah. So thank you guys, and keep up the good work, and we'll get there. Thank you.
Yeah. And just a reminder that the presentation will be posted on our website following this session. And also just visit our homepage for information on upcoming webinars. Next Thursday will be the official launch of our sport tourism event evaluation report. And that'll be done by Ian Edmonston from Legacy Directors International. And also on May 21st, Norm O'Reilly will be with us to take us through the Canadian sponsorship landscape study and some of the projections for sponsorship over the coming months and years. So thanks once again for participating, and have a great rest of day, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.